Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is in no small measure a war that involves hearts and minds, and not just those of foreign populations, but those of the American people, and in particular, the shaping of those young minds by our pedagogy and our society. A man who has just made a very important contribution to shaping those in what I consider to be a very healthy, very important, very positive direction is our first guest. His name is Jeff Gottsfeld. He is an author, a screenwriter, produced for stage and television scripts, and has been just a force of nature, I think, with respect to a lot of different topics, but he has turned his attention most recently to the sacrifice of American servicemen and women in trying to protect the rest of us. And one of the great iconic tributes to that sacrifice, namely the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery. It's a place I've visited from time to time and have always been enormously moved by, and you have captured that sentiment so brilliantly in this book, Jeff, and it's great to have you with us to talk a little bit about 21 Steps, which has as its subtitle, Guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. So pleased to have a chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to make a children's book about this sacred, well, place, yes, but also in a way, institution.
You know, it's odd because I'm probably an unlikely person to be the author of this book. I did not serve in the military. I grew up in liberal Teaneck, New Jersey in the 1960s and 70s. I was a Vietnam War protester. My senses about the military and many American institutions at that time were skeptical at best. But as I grew older, I traveled America. I've been to 46 of the 50 states. I lived in Europe for a time, and I've come to understand that it is a dangerous world out there. There are people who do not have the same commitment to freedom that we do, and most of all, that the United States military, I believe, has been one of the greatest, if not perhaps the greatest, force for good on the planet. So with that as my stance, I wanted to do this book.
And the conveying of the solemnity of the tribute paid hourly by the extraordinary men and women who guard the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is a really remarkable prism through which to tell that story. Talk a little bit about what you're trying to convey in the way of the importance of that sacrifice.
So I tell this story, you know, and it's for third graders now, from the point of view of the first unknown who was interred there in 1921 and who saw everything and who lay there with his war until July 2nd of 1937, when the tomb guards began their post, and it has been unbroken since midnight on that day. Look, you've been to the tomb. You know what I'm talking about. When you stand there and you look at it, and there could be 5,000 people on the plaza or just yourself, you know that in that unknown soldier is someone who belongs to all of us. And the tomb guards, in their quest for perfection and their self-effacement, they belong to all of us. So I believe whether a person is right, left, or center, looking at the tomb, even contemplating it, we know in our hearts that's the best of America in front of us. That's the best of what we can do.
You have had experience talking to children about this book, I guess mostly virtually rather than in person. But talk a little bit about, Jeff Gottsfeld, what response you've gotten from them. Do they get what you're trying to convey? Do they seem to accept this important message about love of country, willingness to sacrifice for it, and why that's so vital to the future of freedom.
You know, in a way, when I read this book to them and they see Matt Tavares's amazing artwork, it's like Plato's Parable of the Caves in the best possible way. So they've come out and they come into this book and they're hearing about things that they don't necessarily know or have stressed in their education. You know, values of the tomb guards, like dignity and honor and sacrifice and patriotism and even obedience and selfless service. And they get it. Look, I have a lot of respect for the kids today. They are taught more about kindness and compassion and tolerance than I ever was. And that is great. But those are not the only values. And in wartime and in military service, those may not be the primary values.
Well, we may not survive if the primary values are not observed and practiced by all of us. And needless to say, the environment in which those kids are being taught what they're taught seems to be, to put it mildly, desperately in need of this kind of appreciation of things bigger than oneself and the importance of protecting our country from what is indeed a dangerous world. So I really commend you for having pulled this together in this form. And it is such a beautiful book, as well as one that has such a powerful message to it. If you were to impart to an audience like mine any single message of why they should be making this book part of their own personal library and sharing it with their children or their grandchildren or their neighbors' kids, for that matter, what would that be?
It comes back to the tomb being an American shrine to responsibility and to selfless service. And that's what we want our kids to know. We know it in our hearts that those two things are massively important. It's a shrine to responsibility, you know, as well. And kids know it's important. Teachers know it's important. That's why my book is being embraced. I think maybe there was a pent up demand waiting for this book to come, because it is being embraced left, right, and center.
I couldn't be more pleased to hear that and more appreciative that you've created something that is getting that kind of response, because it wouldn't necessarily be the case that you'd expect that in today's highly charged political environment. But the message is vital. The cause is of the utmost importance, and your willingness to play a role in helping the rest of us get that is again, deeply appreciated. Jeff Gottsfeld, I thank you for taking the time to talk a little bit about it today. And I hope that you'll come back to us again, both with updates on how this message is being received, but also more broadly, your insights into, well, the kind of environment in which this message is so vitally needed. And this will be a topic for another day's conversation. Thank you for yours today.
I'd be delighted. Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis about a very different message that's being sent to men and women in uniform in the Pentagon leadership today. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is an absolute delight to say we are joined, I believe, for the first time in all these years of recording Secure Freedom Radio, that we are able to feature a woman that I've admired greatly for the work she does at an organization I'm proud to be associated with as well, Breitbart News. It is hard to overstate the importance of the work that Frances Martel does there as an international editor in their news operations. She is helping the rest of us understand the mortal threats to freedom that are now very much on the march, abroad and at home. She does it from the vantage point of a woman whose life experience was shaped by the firsthand travails of her family with Cuban communism And she has devoted so much of her writing and reporting and analysis and editorials to exposing the dangers that we face from Marxists and folks seeking the same ends, albeit perhaps under slightly different banners, including, by the way, Islamists. And it's just indispensable work, I think, and I'm so pleased to be able to showcase her here, and we've agreed that she will come back to us regularly, which would be a wonderful pleasure. Let me just say, Frances, again, thank you for all this great reporting and for the chance to visit with you about it.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. So let's start with something you've just written about, which was the announcement that we discussed yesterday with Reggie Littlejohn about the Communist Party of China announcing that couples there could have three children now, not two, not one. Talk about this as part and parcel of the control that the Chinese Communist Party exercises over its people and the horrific costs associated with it.
Yes. So for decades in China, couples could only have one child legally. And so the way they enforced this is by if women got pregnant a second time, they would be forced to abort or their children would be killed immediately after birth. Many families, if they had a choice of one child, would prefer a son. So there was the mass murder of infant girls for a long, long time, and this is heavily documented. The trauma in that society is tremendous. And what has happened is they have a huge population decline now. The birth rate is collapsing. No one wants to have children. And so in 2016, Xi Jinping, the dictator, said, now you can have two children. Please have more children because our economy needs it. And the birth rate declined further. So when Chinese people were given the option of doubling their family sizes, they actually decreased their family sizes. And at this point, what the government has done is, well, if the two-child policy didn't work, now you can have three children. And so they're basically begging their population to give birth to their slaves, essentially, so that they can keep their economy alive.
And, you know, one point that you made in your piece at Breitbart, Frances Martel, excuse me, 3-1. And one piece that you noted in your article on this subject at Breitbart, Frances Martel, was that this applies only to Han Chinese. It's evidence of sort of the Han supremacist agenda, and others need not apply, including, of course, Uyghur Muslims who are being brutally repressed, genocidally repressed by the Chinese Communist Party. Which brings me to a related subject. The Chinese Communist Party has been pretty horrific to others around the world as well. Specifically, I'm thinking of this coronavirus that they've unleashed upon us. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the degree to which China should be held liable for the murder of over 3 million people as a result of this, biological weapons agent that they, one way or another, made a curse for all of humankind.
So there are basically two categories of the debate regarding is China guilty of causing the pandemic. The first is the origin and nature of the virus, right? Did it come from a lab? Is it naturally occurring? And then the other one is what China did once they knew that they had an outbreak of a novel disease. And for me, I think the second part is much more important because, we'll have debates for years and years to come about the genetic structure and the science of the novel coronavirus. But there's no debate as to what China did once they knew. And what they did was they imprisoned doctors. They disappeared doctors. There was a very famous doctor named Li Wenliang who was arrested for sending a private group text to fellow health workers saying, please wash your hands and use protective gear because I think what we're seeing is contagious. And he died shortly thereafter under mysterious circumstances. So we know that they silenced people simply for saying things like wash your hands and wear a mask. And the other thing they did was they held super spreader events to spread the disease. Obviously, they, we can't say they intentionally tried to kill people, but we do know that Wuhan held a Lunar New Year feast for 130,000 people. They tried to break the Guinness World Record of the biggest banquet ever. This was January. So they knew in November that they had a contagious disease going around, and in January they were hosting super spreader. Yes, yes. And they let 5 million people out of Wuhan to go around the world after they knew that there was a contagious disease. So I think the guilt there, no matter where the virus came from, they are absolutely guilty of causing the pandemic that would have been a local outbreak if they hadn't acted the way they did.
The means by which those reparations for what the Chinese have done to all of us might be extracted is a topic to which I hope we can return with you, Francis. I know you're thinking hard about it as well, and it's very urgent that we do so. But let me ask you about one other aspect of this. You've reported that in Hong Kong, people are, I guess they would call them vax resistors. They're very reluctant to take a not terribly effective Chinese manufactured vaccine, and they're being increasingly coercively compelled to do so. This sounds ominously like what some people have in mind for us here. What is the state of play at the moment, and the evidence, again, of what the Chinese are doing to the people of Hong Kong in the process?
Well, Hong Kong currently has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the developed world. It also has one of the lowest coronavirus rates in the world. So the public doesn't feel any urgency to inject themselves with experimental Communist Party-made drugs. And so what they've done is they initially started offering positive reinforcement, freebies at your local cafes and restaurants and groceries. That didn't work. Carrie Lam, who's the chief executive, came out and openly said, we can't even pay people to take this. So now they're saying, well, if you're not going to take the carrot, then we're going to give you the stick. And the stick is you might be banned from restaurants, groceries, theaters, basically any public socializing venue. And that has the effect of amplifying the repression of the pro-democracy movement, right? Because if you don't trust China and you're, you know, more likely to get involved in the pro-democracy movement, you're probably also going to be the kind of person that isn't going to take the Chinese vaccine.
So, and the means of enforcing this is not just a vaccine passport kind of arrangement, but it taps into the whole social credit system that the Chinese have put in place, as you've reported so well, as a sort of uber totalitarian capability. It's really chilling, and again, I appreciate so much your reporting on what's happening there, because it is a forewarning to what could happen here as well. Let me turn finally to another topic that I know is very much on your mind and on mine as well. It's not getting anywhere near the attention that it requires, and I'm not quite sure why that is, but talk a little bit about a pending election, I guess it's a week or so away now, in Peru. Between two dramatically different candidates. What's at stake there, and what might the effects of what happens there be for the region and perhaps even for us?
Well, I've said the Peruvian presidential election is the most important election around the world this year, probably of the last 5 years, and it's because the candidates are so representative of their ideologies. In Latin America, we see a lot of presidential campaigns where you have a centrist banker versus a milquetoast progressive, and this is not it. Here we have Keiko Fujimori, who is arguably far-right, conservative, law and order, very much core, you know, populist conservative, and then you have Pedro Castillo, who is a Leninist. His party, Free Peru, is openly Leninist, praises Lenin, praises Fidel Castro. He has been accused of having ties to Shining Path, which is a terrorist organization. And so they're basically choosing between an actual communist and an actual, you know, honest-to-goodness conservative. And right now it's neck and neck. Every poll is within the margin of error. So it's very difficult to see what's going to happen, but the choices couldn't be starker. It's hard to believe there's any undecided votes left, but there actually are. And I think that's because Fujimori's reputation and her father's reputation as former president precede, you know, what she's trying to bring to the table. And a lot of people still don't have a great memory of her father, and she's trying to distance herself. But
even though one of the things that her father did was to defeat Shining Path back in the day. But the point here really is, as I understand it, that the parties of the right who have been fractious for many, many years have coalesced behind Keiko simply because they're terrified by what this Castillo character would entail. And that hopefully might yet prevent an outcome that would be devastating for the people of Peru. I think there's no question about it. Think Hugo Chavez and what he did to Venezuela, and it's likely to be on steroids in this case. And as I said, almost certainly have knock-on effects in the region and for perhaps far beyond. Francis Martel, we have to leave it at that for the moment. These are topics to which I hope we can return with you maybe even next week, especially as this election will be upon us. Thank you again for what you do at Breitbart News. It is indispensable and deeply valued by me, and I'm sure my audience as well. And we'll look forward to continuing this conversation with you very soon. Next up, we will speak with Sam Faddis about the challenge that we're facing from, well, Marxists here at home, particularly in our Defense Department. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis, to be precise. He is a former intelligence undercover operative for the Central Intelligence Agency, among many other things, Assistant Attorney General in Washington State, former United States Army officer, a former candidate for Congress, an author of fiction and nonfiction works, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency, a man of many parts, whom I'm proud to call a friend as well as a valued colleague, especially for the work he does on the Committee on the Present Danger China and at andmagazine.com. Tremendous online resource. Sam, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You've done so much important reporting recently, and I want to touch on a couple of them if I can. Particularly urgent to my mind, Sam, is a report that you've recently released about this fellow by the name of Bishop Garrison, not a cleric, but a man who is now, it seems, pursuing with a zealot's passion the purging of patriots from our military. Talk about him, his background, and what he's up to.
Well, Bishop Garrison, as we describe him in the article at AND, is sort of in effect now the commissar for the Department of Defense. I guess we have those now. He is officially the senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense for Diversity and Inclusion, and he runs something called the Countering Extremism Working Group. His job is to root out extremists in the Department of Defense, and in this case, of course, the key there would be what constitutes an extremist. It's clear that what constitutes an extremist in his mind is, well, let's start with anybody who supports Donald Trump, the entire MAGA movement. If you're a white conservative male, you're definitely dead center. He's an adherent to the 1619 Project, which for those who are unfamiliar, basically says that the United States is from its inception, which is defined as 1619 when the first slaves were brought here, an inherently racist, evil, horrible nation that has brought nothing but death and destruction to the globe. And our job is to now to fight all of that, counter all of that, and destroy everything associated with it. So that's Bishop's mission, and he gets paid by the U.S. government to do that.
And it is having an effect on the military, I think it's fair to say, the effect being inevitably to fracture and divide it. Sam, you've served in uniform. You know the importance of unit cohesion, the confidence that those serving have in their comrades in arms in order to be able to fight the enemy and do so decisively and successfully. Is what's in train now likely to make us less able to protect our country, to say nothing of a violation of the oath of office of these men and women in uniform to support and defend the Constitution of the United States if Bishop Garrison has his way?
Yeah, without question. I mean, everybody who's ever been in uniform knows that, look, cohesion is everything. And quite frankly, nobody in the ranks cares what color you are, what your ethnicity is, or any of the rest of this that seems to be of such significance to people. Like, all they care about is, do you have my back? Do you know what you're doing? and we are all brothers and sisters in arms. And that is literally the mantra by which everybody lives, and it's unquestioned. This guy, of course, everything he's about is destroying that foundation. It's tearing the place apart. And of course, it's going to make your loyalty to his, what is expressly Marxist ideology, that's going to be the only thing that really matters here. How far they're going to go with this, I mean, what remains to be seen, obviously, is what's the next step? The fact that there's this training and these briefings are ongoing and everybody's being indoctrinated and required to essentially express loyalty to this ideology, that's where we are. The next step, of course, is what's going to happen when you don't express that loyalty? What is the disciplinary action? How long until we're actually court-martialing or separating personnel because they refuse to adhere to Bishop Garrison's Marxist ideology?
This is the question, of course. And to the extent that we're watching this Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lohmeyer sort of be made a case study in punishing an individual simply because he describes as extremism in the ranks Marxism, when obviously that's not considered to be extremism, at least by Garrison and seemingly the Secretary of Defense and others in the leadership of the Air Force in this case. We're watching the undoing, it would seem to me, of the military, and it's a frightening prospect to contemplate because we're doing this at a very dangerous time in our country's history, as you understand better than just about anybody, Sam. Which brings me to the problem of China. And you've done a lot of reporting, as well as some great work at the Accountability Initiative, which I commend to our audience, accountabilityinitiative.com, I believe it is, that has described what seemed to be profound compromises on the part of many of the personnel in the Biden-Harris administration, starting with the commander-in-chief himself. And you have a piece about what might be one of the results of that compromise by the Chinese Communist Party, in Biden's case, on our policy towards China's ambitions in space. Give us a sense of what that's about and the implications, Sam.
Well, I think most people are probably not focused on the fact that in the immediate future, in the near term, the real prize in this space race, if you will, is the moon. I mean, there's a lot of focus on Mars, I think, for the excitement of the exploration. But the moon is significantly closer, dramatically closer. And there are a tremendous number of resources on the moon. Not to mention that once you have bases on the moon and you are now out of Earth's gravity well, if you will, you can build and launch spacecraft and create other things much faster, much easier, much less energy and expenses involved. So it is, in effect, a strategic high ground, if you will, for the future. And the Chinese are very, very aggressively moving to occupy it. You're not technically not allowed under international treaties to seize property on the moon, but of course the Chinese don't care about that. They seize the South China Sea. And the Chinese have actually declared their full intention to create what they call an exclusive economic zone, which they will control and which will include the moon, and then will allow them to essentially deny permission to anybody else who wants to go there or exploit any of these resources. This is all, I mean, I'm laughing because it's the chutzpah involved here is mind-boggling. But it is real. It is happening. They are moving aggressively. They have a lot of things in train. And if they accomplish this and actually establish these bases and grab these resources, that is a complete game changer for everything on Earth. It may sound like science fiction, but it's not. We're talking things that are going to happen within the next 20 years. And of course, the Biden administration is doing nothing of any significance to counter any of that.
Indeed, it seems as though they are good with it going forward. And that follows, as you've pointed out in your article, Sam, Biden's conduct with respect to the South China Sea back when he was vice president, given the portfolio of trying to prevent the Chinese from taking it over. So this is a worrying precedent and current prospect. And I so appreciate your bringing it to all of our attention at andmagazine.com. Finally, let me turn quickly to something closer to home. Sam, you have been working as now a resident of Pennsylvania to try to ensure that there is both accountability for electoral wrongdoing in the last election cycle and reform to prevent it from happening again. How's that going?
Well, it's not going well. I mean, in brief, the key dynamic here is the dynamic within the Republican Party in the state of Pennsylvania. The base in Pennsylvania, 80% of it, 90% of it, is one place, which is essentially aligned with Donald Trump's principles and convinced absolutely that there was, at a minimum, massive irregularity in the past election. In Harrisburg, they live in a different reality. There's the bulk of the elected representatives want to take us back to pre-2016 politics, aren't particularly sad that Donald Trump is gone, and absolutely do not want to dig into this election. So we are headed rapidly for a collision between these establishment Republicans and the base, which is still white hot and angry and demanding accountability and not getting any of it.
And are we likely to see the Republican Party, which is in the majority in the House and Senate there, stepping up in response to the base's requirements or requests or urgings, at least pleading?
Well, they're not going to step up in response to the pleadings. They've already made that clear. Where we are at this point is rapidly seeing that primary candidates are being mounted. Primary challenges are being mounted to these folks across the state. When they begin to get thrown out of office, they may get religion, but of course that's not the next year. So in the near term, they fully intend to ignore the base. That's precisely where we are, and that's what's fueling the anger.
Understandably, would be infuriating, and we appreciate your leadership in that expression of anger and hopefully bringing about constructive solutions to it. Sam Faddis, thank you for your continuing service to our country and not least your regular appearances here at Secure Freedom Radio. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you, my friend. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we will speak with Lance Crayon. We'll talk with him about China's penetration of someplace closer to home, Hollywood, what it means to you, that and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're going to visit during this block with a very interesting man we've featured from time to time. Always glad to have him with us. His name is Lance Crayon. He is, fellow who has been inside the belly of the beast of Chinese influence operations as an employee of several of their larger influence and propaganda instruments, China Daily and Global Times in Beijing. And he spent some time working for them as well in Los Angeles. He has insights, therefore, into what is a very comprehensive, far-reaching effort on the part of the Chinese communists to take us down through the suborning of various parts of our society, our institutions, our politicians, and the like. And what I wanted to ask him to feature prominently today is what China has been doing, the Chinese Communist Party specifically, to recruit and utilize Hollywood for this larger purpose. Lance, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk to us about a topic that I suspect most of us are oblivious to, but had better be paying attention to for the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So I'm interested in sort of the multifaceted way China's been getting its hands around Hollywood. Maybe we could start with its purchase of a number of movie theaters across this country and what impact that has had on how Hollywood has viewed China.
Sure. I mean, it really began, I think you could pinpoint it in 2012 when President Biden was vice president. He met with Xi Jinping, and when Xi Jinping was vice president, and they changed the quota in China, the film quota, to 34 films. Previously, it was like, I think, 24 foreign films allowed to play in theaters in China. That right there set the stage for the expansion of China, where they were able to go from 5,000 screens to 60,000 screens within, you know, 5 or 6 years. So
inside
with that,
China.
With that move, go ahead.
Inside China.
Exactly, inside China. With that move, Hollywood became reliant on Chinese audiences because films that weren't films that had made money in America or films that had already played or new films, of course, were receiving a substantial financial boost, you know, from the Chinese market. Whereas in the past, they were being ripped off because the bootleg market in China, the DVD bootleg market, had already, you know, siphoned well over $1 billion from Hollywood.
So the Chinese got a presence in this country and a growing capacity to show films from Hollywood, a select few that they would approve. And how did that approval process translate into censorship of American films for both the Chinese and American audiences?
China made it very clear that without their approval, then their American films simply would not play in the mainland. And the only way that films would play in the mainland was through the illegal market. So Hollywood would lose if it did not answer to China. So China slowly rolled out, you know, rules, censorship rules that American actors, American studios had to follow. And if they didn't, then the films simply would not play in the mainland. And if they, you know,
and if they didn't play in the mainland, as you say, Lance, they would be denied enormous revenue. So there's a powerful incentive here to go along and get along, I guess. And when you know of this, how has that actually materially affected what kinds of films are broadcast, first of all, and or not broadcast, what kinds of films are shown in China, and editorial decisions made about what they show or don't show?
Basically, the studios answer to China. U.S. studios are answering to China. That's what it means. You'll notice the types of films that are being made just here in America, whether they play in China or not, are nowhere near as racier, let's say, as they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. The standard of what a rated R film is, the content has been, you know, drastically reduced for China. Even if the film is not approved by China to play in the theaters, it still doesn't mean that it can't be streamed on streaming platforms. So, you know, there's another block process involved there where China will block those films from streaming platforms, not just theaters, if they do not adhere to Chinese standards as opposed to American standards.
Yeah. Now, some in our audience may say, well, it's not a bad thing if films are less racy coming out of Hollywood. There's too much violence. There's too much sex in them. But in addition to those kinds of changes, there's also been content with respect to, you know, portrayal of the Chinese as enemies of this country and Taiwan as a friend of this country, for example. Have there not? And my interest here is not just, you know, what are the Chinese exposing their publics to, but also whether that means that films that could and should be made for American audiences are going, as they say, on the cutting room floor.
Exactly. They won't get made. If anything could be construed as offensive by Chinese standards, that film will not be made. And if, let's say, for example, it is, okay, then there will be penalties. China could impose sanctions on other countries that play this film, even though it doesn't play in China. If a film that is made that China doesn't approve of, or that recognizes Taiwan as a country, then there would be problems, not just for Hollywood, but for the countries who played that film.
So it's a ripple effect, and people would be very chary, presumably, of causing the ire of China at any step in this sort of industry food chain, whether it's, you know, script writing, whether it's talent making the movies, whether it's the actual production, editing, dissemination, and the theaters. I mean, there's lots of places in which the Chinese are able to now exercise, well, a veto, I guess is one way of putting it. And we've seen this in a dramatic way, haven't we, with this wrestler-type actor John Cena. Talk a little bit about what you mentioned Taiwan and its recognition as a country. Talk about his contortions with respect to having given offense to the Chinese.
Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, that's a perfect example because, you know, he acknowledged Taiwan as a country, and so the mainland China, his fans of mainland China, he's in a movie now called Fast and Furious. I think it's Part 9, which is like a major franchise, global franchise film. So he, by recognizing Taiwan as a country, the backlash in mainland China was, you know, this is offensive. You've offended us. You've disgraced the nation, you know, at the worst time possible because China could shut that film down. I mean, that film opening weekend, I think, you know, made over $100 million in mainland alone. So to give you an idea, like other actors, you'll notice how actors, this is across the board, not just John Cena, but actors are always speaking out for causes and human rights violations. Well, you know, Hollywood actors haven't said a word about Taiwan, for example, COVID, Xinjiang, or the Hong Kong protests. They've been completely, completely quiet.
Yeah. And some of those causes, at least one would think, would be passionate issues for those in Hollywood who want to be seen as on the side, for example, of, you know, Muslim victims of oppression or those who are subjected to slave labor and the like. And I'm reminded of the example of Richard Gere, who long before John Cena probably walked the earth, was blacklisted by the Chinese for not Taiwan, but his support for Tibet. That's an object lesson, I presume, for everybody else in Hollywood. What has become of his career?
Well, you'll notice since he was nominated for Academy Award for a film called Arbitrage, which I think was like 2011, 2012, around there, we really haven't seen him in any film since. Granted, I mean, you know, he is a bit older, but you know that shouldn't matter. But he was going from, you know, 5, 6, 7 films a year to nothing. I think he's doing an obscure TV now, a television series, maybe a few episodes, and that's it. He's fallen off the map since Xi Jinping became president since 2012, 2013. We really haven't heard from Richard Gere.
He's been blackballed. And lots of folks in Hollywood are terrified of that. John Cena's, as I say, kowtowing to the Chinese is the freshest evidence of it. And Lance, I guess what we're really to take away from this is we've watched the penetration of China into a major force in shaping our culture, and that can't be good. And I appreciate you describing it for us and helping us become alive to the dangers that it represents. And we'll be back to you to talk about more on Julie Su, a woman you've written about, an example, it seems, of a corrupted politician. But that's for another day. Thanks for your time on this occasion. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.